Let's talk. John Brown.
The ukulele man is the story of a prisoner of war of the Japanese and his ukulele. It's all about Tom Boardman, a talented ukulele player from Lee in Lancashire. I've covered many things of the Second World War, but it never fails to surprise me. I'm delighted to say that the author of The Ukulele Man is Ray Whisnell, and Ray joins us live on the line now. Ray, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Morning. How are you?
I'm very well. We're having an interesting morning here this morning, you can see my technical people are working. That's not just to get me working. That's to get the studio working. But there you go. So if you hear any bangs and whistles and screaming, that's not me or any of my guests. Tell me a little bit about yourself and why you are where this story comes from. Why are you qualified, Ray?
Yeah. Okay. Well, my father was a D-Day veteran. And he fought all the way through from Normandy right through to Germany. And a few years ago, I took a great interest in my father's experience and got into researching military history. And my wife is a lovely Thai lady, lives in a place called Ubon Ratchathani in northeast Thailand. And it was about 12 years ago when we discovered that there was a prisoner of war camp in this town, and there was no written history about it. So that was my project, was to discover the history of the Ubon prisoner of war camp.
I mean, had you been an armchair historian, interested in sort of bits and pieces and with a keen interest in the Second World War?
Yeah. It was a little bit later in life. I worked abroad for many, many years. And when I came back from that, spent more time with mum and dad. And they regularly went over to Normandy in June to commemorate D-Day. And it was on the first trip there that I realised just what my father, as a 19-year-old boy, was facing when he landed on Gold Beach on D-Day +7. And it was that really that inspired me to, you know, get to understand what it was like for my dad. And from that, everything else has just come along.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because people would say, OK, I want to go and I will look at battle sites or fortifications or, you know, in Normandy. Prisoner of war camps, obviously you kind of know the horrors that were visited upon the people in there, so that must have been quite a for you to approach this must have been quite an emotional and to keep it respectful, as it were, Ray.
Well it was a bit really, and it all started when we visited the Commonwealth War Graves site at Kanchanaburi in Thailand, and looking at around about 7,000 graves there of men who suffered on the Thai-Burma Railway. And I got interested in that side of it because, to be honest, I didn't really know a lot about it. And it was through those sort of researching avenues that I was following that I discovered that this camp existed at Ubon. But shortly after that, I was invited to the Researching Far East Prisoners of War History Group conference at Liverpool in 2015, and there I met Tom Boardman.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He was one of the very few surviving prisoners of war in 2015, and during the conference, in between a couple of presentations, Tom raised his hand and he asked if anybody in the room had any more up-to-date photographs of a feature on the railway called the Wampo Viaduct. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing, because I was actually stood on the Wampo Viaduct the week before taking photographs.
So he must have gone, wow, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so I introduced myself to Tom, and that's when we formed this friendship. We did a few family projects together with his son, Ron Boardman, who is co-author of the book with me.
When talking about the camp, obviously the railway is presumably, I mean, the bridges are still there. Is the camp still there? I mean, or is it just the ground, as it were? I mean, it's not.
There's not an awful lot of POW features remaining because, it was 80 odd years ago, and time does pass quickly. But the railway still exists from from its start, which is a place called Nonkladuk, and it goes about 150 kilometres north to a place called Namtok. And along that railway, you can find various features, various landmarks of places that the POWs were, including this Wampo Viaduct.
So, you know, Tom himself, you're speaking to this man, and I know the people say, well, a lot of veterans didn't talk about their time in the Second World War. They just, it was a job and they got on with it. Obviously, if you were a prisoner of war, I imagine that it was doubly so. So what was it like when you actually, did you sort of walk up to him and say, well, here's some pictures? I mean, what was he like as a person?
Well, Tom was as surprised as I was that I had, you know, very recent photographs of the Wampo Viaduct. And to be fair, Tom, at that time, he was 95 years old. And he, you know, obviously when he came back from the Far East, he was about 26, 27 years old. So it's a long time. And during that time, he mellowed. So, you know, he came back not very happy with the Japanese, to put it mildly. But over the years, he mellowed and came to terms with the trauma that he'd been through and was very open about his experiences. And hence, that's why he was at that conference at that particular time.
So the book is called The Ukulele Man. I mean, obviously, a musical instrument features here, unless he had a whole collection of George Formby records underneath his arm. So I mean, is he a ukulele? So how does he, is he in Singapore? I mean, how does he, what, just give me the background to how he sort of ends up in you know, that particular, in the prisoner of war camp. How does he get there? And yeah.
Okay, well, Tom was a good ukulele player, an amateur player before the war. But when war broke out in 1939, he, within 1 week of war breaking out, he joined the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. And after his training as an explosives, in explosives storekeeping, which was quite a dangerous job and lengthy, and after that training, he was assigned to go to the Far East, and he landed in Singapore in June 1941. And Tom was quite surprised because there was no fighting at that time, but there was a real threat that the Japanese would attack, which is what they did in December 1941, at the same time as the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And they gradually made their way down to Singapore within 70 days, and Singapore surrendered, and that's when Tom became a POW, along with approximately 130,000 other men.
Yeah, indeed, and also civilians as well. I mean, it was the whole. It wasn't just army personnel or, you know, military personnel, wasn't it? It was basically a huge amount of people were forced out of Singapore.
Yeah, there was a lot of civilians as well. excuse me, people who were working in Singapore in the rubber and tin industries, because Singapore was a world market at that time, and a lot of expats were out there who got all caught up in this war as well.
So the ukulele that he's been playing, because he's been enjoying the good life in Singapore. I mean, come on, he's from Lancashire, and I'm not saying that Lancashire isn't the greatest county in the world, but perhaps to go to Singapore, you know, a young lad, 19, he's got his ukulele, he's having, you know, it's a fantastic, an eye-opening experience for him. But he's, I mean, this is, the ukulele isn't just what he's got. Isn't it a gift from his wife or his girlfriend or what?
No, actually what happened was on his way to Singapore, they called in at Cape Town in South Africa, and that's where he bought what is described as a banjolele, obviously a cross between a banjo and a ukulele. And it's that instrument that he lost when Singapore surrendered. But also, before he left England, his wife gave him a gold ring. And it was rather unusual because it was in the design of intertwined snake heads with rubies in each head. And he insisted on taking it with him. Irene, his wife, didn't want him to do that, but he insisted. And when they were captured, the Japanese were taking what we call trophies, and Tom didn't want to lose this ring, so that's when he hid it in a bar of soap.
Okay. So he was allowed to take a bar of soap with him.
Yeah. He had his sort of a few personal possessions, including this this bar of soap. So he scooped out. excuse me. He scooped out some of the soap and embedded the ring in that. Put the shavings back. Used it a couple of times. Then it was in the bottom of his kit bag for 3.5 years.
Fair enough. So they marched from Singapore into northeast Thailand. Explain how it
happened. Well, the Japanese decided that they wanted to build a railway to connect Thailand with what was then called Burma, Myanmar as it is now, and they wanted to do that because they'd already captured Burma from the British Empire, and they wanted to consolidate their position there. Also, they had an eye to invade India at some point. And to do that, you need to send a lot of men and a lot of material. And they couldn't go by sea because there was a threat of submarine attack. And frankly, they didn't have enough shipping to do that anyway. So they had a workforce. They decided to build a railway. And Tom was sent up there with 60,000 other prisoners from Singapore in what amounted to cattle wagons. And there was about 30 men plus all their equipment and gear to each of these wagons. And in a 4 or 5 day journey from Singapore up to just to the west of Bangkok, in terrible, terrible conditions, because a lot of these men were suffering illnesses, things like dysentery and malaria. There was no facilities for them at all to for their comfort, or and the food situation was really bad as well. Very, very hot during the day, freezing cold at night, extremely uncomfortable. And when they got there, things were no better. In fact, they got gradually worse.
Fair to say that the journey was probably a precursor. You know, if you think the journey was bad, well, the conditions were, as we know, were horrendous. But this is called this book is called the Ukulele Man. So, how does the ukulele reappear? What's the story with this, Ray?
Okay. Well, I mentioned that Tom had bought this banjolele in Cape Town. Well, when Singapore surrendered, he lost that. We're not quite sure how he lost it, but it was probably in the face of battle. so he was very disappointed. But then the Japanese, before they sent him to Thailand, they sent him to work in some derelict, bombed-out properties. And in that property, he found a mangled mandolin. And the mandolin has 8 strings, and it has 8 tuning pegs. These are the twiddly bits at the end. And he thought, oh, I can take these and I'll make a ukulele. Well, he went back to camp and he did make a ukulele. He made 2, actually. This first one he described as a cigar box type. Too small, not loud enough, was his comment. But it lasted him 2 years. He took it with him on the railway, and it survived. But then when the railway was completed, Tom went back to a camp called Chiang Kai, much better camp, relatively, and it was there that Tom decided to make his second ukulele. And he drew out a specification of what he wanted, including, and this is really the crucial part for your listeners that know a little bit about ukuleles and guitars, is that you can play around with the tuning pegs all day long and alter the pitch of the strings. But if you get the frets on the fretboard in the wrong position, it doesn't play the right note. And Tom was very particular. He wanted to make this as accurately as he could. But what he knew was something called the Rule of 18. And the Rule of 18 is a calculator that tells you how to position the frets on the fretboard. It's where mathematics and music come together. And with the Rule of 18, it's difficult to explain on the radio, but where the tuning pegs are, there's something called the nut, and where the on the other end of the ukulele, where the bridge is, that distance between those two points is called the scale length. And when you divide the scale length by 18, you get the position of the first fret.
Okay, we're with you so far. Okay, yeah.
And so Tom worked out excuse me, this where to position each of the frets by this rule of 18 calculation. And once he got the position of the first fret, you take that distance away from the original distance, divide it by 18 again, you get a slightly slightly lower distance, and that's the position of the second fret, and you do that so on and so on and so on for all of the 12 fret positions on the ukulele. And finally, what the rule of 18 says is the position of the 12th fret should be exactly halfway between the nut and the bridge. And in the Imperial War Museum in Salford in England, we have the ukulele on display. And when we took that out for some inspection and photography, we measured that distance, and the position of that 12th fret is 2 millimetres out from halfway position.
Wow. Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, because we know there are horrors in the camps. We know that it is undescribable brutality and cruelty. I'm amazed that he's actually got, because people are dying from dysentery, people are, you know, falling by the side of the road, and we know that not all of them, but many of the Japanese guards were horrendous to their prisoners. You would think they would have smashed the ukulele just because they could. So why did they allow him to do something that would bring sort of comfort to the rest of the prisoners?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure that I've got the correct answer, but what we can assume is that the Japanese guards, and you know, they've been away from their families and homes just as long as the POWs had, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, some of them been away, and they were just as fed up as the prisoners. And also the Japanese didn't provide that kind of entertainment for their guards as well. So, you know, they wanted entertaining. They wanted to do things as well. So they tolerated the prisoners producing music and putting on concerts. Because don't forget, amongst the prisoners, there was musicians like Tom, but there was actors, there were singers, there was entertainers like comedians and magicians, and they put on concert parties. And that was a big business. And men who were not so talented on entertaining, they would build stages, they would build sets, they would build scenery, makeup, costumes, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it was like putting on a show. Again, this is something that we don't normally think of when we think about the prisoners of war camps that the Japanese were in, because we think it was totally sort of brutal and they were sort of starving and you know, emaciated. But they were actually, you know, at some point in certain camps, they were able to do this to entertain themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. It depended on the commandant of the camp, of course, and there was red lines.
Sure.
And if they went over those red lines, then that was a bit of trouble. But you're right. I mean, we must not forget that there was over 650 prisoner of war camps run by the Japanese in Southeast Asia, and a lot of the other camps, the men were treated very, very badly, you know, and death was sometimes a comfort to these guys. It was that bad. But also there were some camps like the ones that Tom was in, where it was very bad. Don't get me wrong, but it wasn't as bad as some of the other camps, and men were able to find the strength to survive and continue. And it was through people like Tom that these men got through. You know, he was an inspiration. He had a very strong will to live. Making the ukulele was his way of dealing with this. But of course, once he'd made it, he'd got his music back, so he was able to join in these concert parties, and also on an individual basis, he was playing amongst his friends in what I call jam sessions and in the hospitals to entertain, you know, all the sick guys that were there. But let's not forget that Tom was also sick himself. He'd had 32 bouts of malaria whilst working on the railway. He'd had something called beriberi and another thing called pellagra, and these are vitamin deficiency diseases. He'd had dysentery almost continuously for 3.5 years. And apart from cuts and bruises and, you know, the odd tooth extraction, it was not very pleasant. But somehow Tom survived all of this and got through.
What about the ring? Because we mentioned the interesting sort of ring that his wife had given him, and presumably he would. I mean, even if he uses it sparingly, a couple of years in the camp, he's going to go through it. So, did he? Where did he? You know, as long as it's not too graphic, Ray, where did he stash the ring?
Well, as I mentioned, he hid it in this bar of soap, and the bar of soap went in the bottom of his kit bag and virtually was forgotten about for 3.5 years. And when the camp was liberated, Tom was then able to crack open this this cake of soap, which he described as being like as solid as a brick. Can imagine it had not been used for that length of time. And much to the amazement of his fellow prisoners, this ring appeared. And, you know, that it was as simple as that, really. We have a photograph on the front of the book of Tom holding the ukulele that he made, and on his wedding ring finger, you can see this.
I'm looking at it now. That's absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And you are right. It is an unusual ring. So he gets back and with the ukulele, a bit of a legend. And obviously, if it's in the Imperial War Museum, I think it's great that he brought it all the way back. From where he was.
Yeah. Exactly. He came back from the Far East on the. A ship called the SS Corfu. It was the first troop ship back into Southampton in October 1945. And, that photograph on the front of the book is one that appeared in the Daily Dispatch on the 8th of October 1945. The ring is still in the family. Obviously a very important family heirloom, which is brought out on various occasions to entertain people, and it's, you know, its value is just immense because it's got such a history behind it.
So when it comes to writing this book, I mean, how did you put it together? Because obviously, I mean, you met with Tom, and you mentioned you met his son as well. So did he have sort of first hand accounts? I mean, how did you put it together?
Ron is a very good friend, and he's very extremely helpful. And sadly, Tom died in 2019, just before COVID. And then COVID came along, obviously, and so everything was what it was. But shortly after that, Ron was going through some things in his house, and he found this suitcase. And he'd not looked into it before, but when he opened it, he found 16 books. About the Thai Burma Railway, some extremely very old books that were written just after the war, and lots of papers and diaries that Tom had handwritten, and Ron had never seen these before, but he said to me, "Ray, can you sort this out for me?" So I said, "Yeah, no problem." And when I finished sorting all these things out, it was obvious that there was a story behind this with these original diaries that. Tom had written, including the sketch of his ukulele. There's over 80 songs that he's written the chord changes to in this diary. So you see things like Moon River, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and all this with all the chord changes in there. And he's written such notation, you know, it's amazing. And also some accounts, because he gave talks to societies, and he wrote his notes out copiously before the talks, and all these were there. So, you know, it was great.
It's really interesting because, I mean, a lot of the time we hear about, especially those who were captured at Singapore, and they're never the same again. They come back, obviously they come back with health problems. You mentioned malaria and stuff like that, but a lot of them sort of have psychological problems. And I'm not saying this is a cure-all, but he had his music, And that got him through it, if you like, and other men as well. And by the sounds of it, he didn't turn into the sort of he wasn't a big fan of the Japanese, obviously, but alternatively, he wasn't a shell of a man who never got his life back together afterwards.
Yeah, when Tom came back, obviously, as you say, that he wasn't too happy with the Japanese, but he very soon decided that. If he had this hatred inside him, it would only be affecting him. he couldn't really express this out, you know. So he decided that he could forgive, but he could never ever forget. And that's you know, so that was so important. That was really Tom Boardman summed up. And he joined a lot of organisations that had fellow prisoners of war in them, and together they could talk, because to explain what they'd been through to somebody who had not experienced those things, they found difficult. But talking with another person who'd had the same or similar experiences was much easier. And Tom did an awful lot of that stuff after the war.
The book is called The Ukulele Man, the story of a prisoner of war of the Japanese and his ukulele. Listeners, you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. It is by Ray Widnall and Ron Boardman. Ray, do you have a website? Are you online? Do you do social media? Is there somewhere they can find you?
Social media, but I do have a Facebook page, a Facebook author page as well. So I upload regular snippets of information. I've just recently come back from Thailand and met a fellow researcher over there, and we've you know, there's photographs and bits of stories about it as well. So I mean that on Facebook, that would be good if people would
brilliant.
Go and have a look.
Follow you on that one. The book is called The Ukulele Man. It's by Ray Withnell. Go and find him online. Ray, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great fun and a pleasure as well. Enjoyed it.